So let me start by thanking the organizers for inviting me to this conference. It's been a great conference so far. I've been asked to talk about substructure in the halo of the Andromeda Galaxy. And I'll talk about substructure in the component that we've been studying, which is the stellar component in the halo of the Andromeda Galaxy. I hope to touch upon the following three topics. I'll start by describing briefly the extended stellar halo of Andromeda, because this is something that was that's really come to our attention in the last year and a half or so. I'll then talk about substructure in the form of tidal debris in the halo of Andromeda, and then at the very end, if I have time, I'll talk a little bit about ongoing disruption of dwarf satellites of Andromeda. So this work in one form or another has been going on for the last decade and a half if I take proper count of this. So I'm here representing a large, diverse, evolving team of people. And I wanted to highlight the names of a few people here. There are a couple of ongoing PhD theses at UC Santa Cruz. Carrie Gilbert's work, something I'll touch upon. And Kirsten Howley's work is also something I'll mention. Kirsten's at this conference. There's also several former PhD theses at UCSC, Marla Jiha, Phil Choi, David Reitzel. There are a couple of postdocs who've been making great contributions to this, Jason Kalerai, Mark Ferdahl, and Andrea Font. Most of what I'll talk about relies on taking spectra of individual stars in the Andromeda Galaxy, and this is could have been made possible by a new spectrograph. Well, not new anymore, but it's been around for 5 years now. A spectrograph on the Keck telescope called DMOS. Now, we'd started this process with the previous generation spectrographs on Keck, but DMOS has really made the process much more efficient. So the first part, I'll talk about the extended stellar halo of Andromeda and start by showing you a picture. This wonderful star count map of the Andromeda Galaxy. This particular map was published by Annette Ferguson and collaborators in 2002. And the year before that, Rodrigo Ibata and collaborators, part of the same team, pointed out the existence of this giant stream, tidal debris, from a disrupted satellite, presumably, in the Andromeda Galaxy. Now, this is an unusual view of the Andromeda Galaxy. You're used to seeing pictures that look more like this. I can get this to show up. Oops. Sorry about that. Let me go back to that. You're used to seeing pictures that look more like, there we go, something like that. And what will happen is, as the contrast increases in that image, you'll see that that high contrast CCD image of Andromeda corresponds to the burnt out part of the star count map. So Ferguson et al. Star count map actually probed much further out into Andromeda than had previously been possible. And it's well known that if you study individual stars, you can get down to arbitrarily low surface brightness levels. I've highlighted some of the areas in this map of Andromeda that we've been targeting with a variety of telescopes and instruments. These include wide field imaging from the ground, very deep imaging with ACS on the Hubble Space Telescope to get down to the main sequence turnoff and measure stellar ages. And like I said before, our bread and butter has been getting spectra with the DMOS spectrograph on Keck. Now, this seems like a really wide field view of Andromeda, but let me show you an even wider field view of Andromeda. The star count map that you just saw fits in there. That's the grayed out area in the upper right. We thought we were, when we were going that far out in away from the center of Andromeda, this is something like 12, 13 degrees away from the center of Andromeda, we thought these would serve as control fields. But to our surprise, we have actually identified red giant stars belonging to Andromeda in all of these fields that you see marked here. Thank you. 165 kiloparsecs is the radius of the outermost field. We are actually beginning to probe a little bit beyond that. Let me see if I can get that to show up here. So this outermost ring has a radius of 165 kiloparsecs in projection. And these were the fields that we had observed until last year. This year we've been able to expand this and cover a lot more fields, better azimuthal coverage in general. And in fact, this is the census after our most recent run, which is as recent as last month. We have a couple more runs coming up later this year. So we're beginning to really blanket this area around the Andromeda galaxy. And really what has made this thing possible is a technique that Carrie Gilbert, my graduate student at Santa Cruz, has been developing, which is a technique to identify very sparse groups of Andromeda stars against the much denser foreground of Milky Way stars. Milky Way dwarf stars contaminate any study of the outer parts of Andromeda. Really what you've got are stars that are faint in apparent magnitude, but they could either be intrinsically low luminosity dwarf stars in our own galaxy, or they could be luminous giants at a great distance, at the distance of Andromeda. And to tell these two groups apart is not easy. We're using a combination of techniques that I'll talk about in just a bit. But the bottom line is, using these techniques, we're able to detect needles in a haystack and really explore the halo of Andromeda out to radii approaching 200 kiloparsecs. This is about 3 to 5 times further out than had previously been possible. Now, we detect M31 red giants in all our fields, and what I'm about to show you is the star counts correspond to something that seems to be well in excess of the inner bulge-like structure. M31 has a large luminous bulge, which is well fit by Sersich law, and the counts we are detecting correspond to surface brightnesses that are well in excess of that extrapolation of that Sersich law. Now, let me say a word or two about how we find these stars. Before we go to the telescope to get spectra of stars, we pre-filter our target lists using narrowband images. These are images taken through the so-called DDO51 filter. It's an intermediate width filter that keys in on a particular feature in the spectrum of stars. This is a spectrum of a red giant star. This is a spectrum of a foreground dwarf. They have very different surface gravities. And that shows up in that absorption feature that's marked by the gray band. The gray band marks the DDO51 filter. And you can imagine that a star with a notch like that due to magnesium hydride and magnesium B is going to have a different look in this color diagram than a red giant that's featureless. So this is the Washington system M and T2 bands. This is like a V minus I color, and this is a broadband minus narrow band or intermediate width band measurement. So in this color space, foreground dwarfs form this kind of hook, whereas red giants form a cloud. So you can get rid of many of your contaminants even before taking spectra. So this is what we do. And then Carrie Gilbert's work, uses a bunch of diagnostics. I'll just describe a couple of them. If you look at radial velocity space, foreground stars in our galaxy are expected to be, at least in the direction of Andromeda, are expected to have velocities close to about minus 50 heliocentric. Whereas Andromeda, some of you may know, has a systemic velocity of minus 300 heliocentric. But it has a broad distribution of velocity. So in velocity space, these two populations overlap. Now, this doesn't look too severe. The overlap doesn't look too severe because I've normalized these two curves so that they have equal area under them. If you go out to the outskirts of Andromeda, these stars are 100 times more common than these kinds. So you have to scale this down by a factor of 100, and then you can see that the tail of this distribution can completely wipe out your signal. So we rely on radial velocity as one of our diagnostics, but that alone is not enough. We use the DDO51 parameter, which is, as I just described, is sensitive to surface gravity. We also use the strength of the sodium one line. It's a doublet that is also gravity and temperature sensitive. This is to give you a sense of what that looks like. These are confirmed foreground stars drawn from fields that are far away from Andromeda. These are confirmed red giant stars that are drawn from fields that are right near the center of Andromeda. You can see they have a different behavior in terms of their sodium line strength as a function of temperature. V minus I color is a surrogate for the effective temperature of the star. And in particular, for cool stars, there's a very strong sodium doublet in dwarfs, but not in giants. You can use this as well. And I'll go through some of the other diagnostics here. You can use the position within the CMD. In particular, M31 red giants are expected to be, are expected to have brightnesses up to a certain level, which corresponds to the tip of the red giant branch, but you don't expect to see a lot of them brighter than that value, whereas, of course, foreground stars smoothly straddle that boundary. The calcium line strength can be used. The comparison of the calcium line strength to the position of the star in the CMD. There are a couple of gravity-sensitive potassium lines and three TiO bands, titanium oxide bands. So Kerry puts all of this together to identify the stars that we have in our sample. Now, we've used a sort of a likelihood-based approach, and I won't go into the details of this. This is all on AstroPH. But as we march out in radius, each of these histograms represents one field. This is the innermost field at 12 kiloparsecs projection. This is at 165. And things that are to the right of zero, things that have positive likelihood values, are likely to be red giants, because that's how we define our likelihood. It's the probability of something being a giant divided by the probability of it being a dwarf. So things with positive values are likely giants, and things with negative values are likely to be foreground dwarfs. And you can see the balance of giants to dwarfs shifts as you march out in radius. This field is at about 60 kiloparsecs in projection, but equal quantities of both types of stars. But by the time you march out in radius, the balance shifts almost entirely to foreground stars, but almost entirely. There's still a few stars here that we're convinced are red giants in Andromeda. We've looked at these stars in all of these 10 diagnostic spaces, and in every way, these stars look like red giants in Andromeda. Okay. This is what it implies for the surface brightness distribution. Let me draw your attention to the lowest panel here. These are old star count and integrated light measurements of Andromeda's bulge, the spheroid, plus some contribution from the disk on the minor axis, and you can see that's reasonably well fit by a Sersich, n equals 2 Sersich law. R counts are well in excess of that. They're well fit by an R to the minus 2.6 in projection power law. Now, as I said, the red giants, even in our outermost field, are the ones marked with these bold symbols or the bold histogram, and you can see in four of these diagnostics, the four that are shown here, these bold symbols follow the expected distribution for giants, which are these bold contours. These contours are based on training set giants, objects that are confirmed to be giants, and whereas the X's, which are the confirmed dwarfs, follow the expected distribution of dwarf stars. And that's this dot dashed histograms here and the crosses down here. All right. Let me say a little bit about debris trails in the Andromeda Halo. This is a recent paper by Mark Ferdahl and collaborators. You've seen the star count map already. Here's this giant stream. In his attempts to model the orbit of the giant stream, Mark has come to the interesting conclusion that the giant stream might well be associated with two other features in this star count map. This northeast shelf had been noted by Ferguson and collaborators a while back, and you might see that in the star count map, the density of star counts is higher here than beyond it. This sort of marks the edge of the shelf. Mark noted that there's a similar shelf on the western side of Andromeda as well. This is an edge-filtered version of that map, and you can see the northeast shelf and the western shelf here. And one of the favored orbits for the progenitor of this giant stream takes it through this location It goes through Perry Center. The first Apo Center produces this northeast shelf. It goes through Perry Center again, and the second Apo Center produces this western shelf. So it seems like a promising orbit for the giant stream, and it looks like M31 has a young shell system. Just to give you quickly the conclusions of what Mark found in his paper, we actually started with test particle orbits in a static potential. This is the work of Rodrigo Ibarta and his group published a paper in 2004. Our group published a paper using very similar techniques, using test particles in a static potential. We then went on to refine this potential. This is Gihan et al. 2006. And Mark then had an N-body satellite in an M31 potential. In this most recent work, you know, we sort of raised this question of could the stream, there's a concentration of planetary nebulae, eastern shelf and western shelf, be associated with a single event? We think the answer is yes. Okay. Now, something interesting about the substructure in Andromeda. This is the giant southern stream in two different fields. Here's an outer field. Seen in a plot of metallicity versus radial velocity, you'll notice that the substructures tend to be more metal-rich than the dynamically hot populations. This is most easily apparent over here, where this cold population, and we've now tripled our sample here very recently, but this cold population seems to be more metal-rich than the dynamically hotter population. We see this in another field here. This is, if I look at this broad population here, it seems to have superposed on it a colder population, and most of that colder population comes from metal-rich stars above that line. Okay. Now, you see the same sort of effect in numerical simulations of, say, the kind that Catherine Johnson and James Bullock have run. These are snapshots from their simulations. What you see here is a surface brightness map of four simulated galaxy halos. Here is the same halo, but with the color coding indicating metallicity. And one of the things you'll notice is the bright streams tend to be metal rich, whereas faint streams, like the one you can barely see over here, tend to be metal poor. So the brownish green color represent metal rich stars, the sort of blue green represent metal poor. And the reason for this in their simulation is they've built in a correlation between metallicity and the luminosity of the dwarf satellite that's merging into the Andromeda halo. So the luminous satellites tend to be the most metal-rich ones. They are the ones that tend to produce the most prominent streams. And we seem to be seeing the same sort of effect in our data. Okay. To wrap this up, ongoing tidal disruption of M31's dwarf satellite. I just wanted to show you a quick result from Marla Jeher's work. This is NGC 205. And if you look in detail at its outer isophotes, it's been noted for a long time that it has this sort of S shape to it. If you try to fit the outer isophotes to ellipses, there's a clear twisting of the outer isophotes compared to the ones. So Marla and collaborators, we went out and got spectra of, in this case, 730 red giants. We were talking about trying to constrain the internal dynamics of satellites using hundreds to thousands of stars. We're trying to get there with this now. And what she finds is the mean velocity of NGC 205 shows a clear signature of rotation in the inner parts, but then at about the radius where the tidal distortion starts, the sense of rotation or the sense of the velocity, radial velocity, reverses completely. So we think this is due to tidal distortion of the outer parts of Andromeda the outer parts of NGC 205 by Andromeda, and suggests that it's on a prograde orbit. And in fact, Kirsten is modeling this encounter using a genetic algorithm to try and constrain the orbital trajectory, internal dynamics, dark matter content, and you know what's going to happen to 205 in the future. Ultimately, we also want to model its effect on the Andromeda disk. So here's just another satellite, NGC 147, that shows rotation, but not this turnover. You should be able to use this to constrain its dark matter content. So my conclusions are, we have an extended halo of stars in Andromeda. It's radius comparable to what we expect the virial radius to be of these L-starish galaxies. We see clear evidence of substructure. The statistical comparisons to numerical simulations seem to make sense in terms of the metallicity surface brightness correlations. It's clear that dwarf galaxies are acting as building blocks, at least for this halo. You can see photometric and kinematic distortions in the outer parts of these satellites. We're in the process of comparing them to simulations to better understand their trajectories. And in the future, we hope to measure detailed elemental abundances and stellar ages. Thank you.
Questions? Hi, Roger. That's really great work. I had two quick questions. I mean, you mentioned something about constraining the potential of M31, but didn't say a whole lot specific. And I was wondering if the total mass is still inferred to be less than that of the Milky Way.
As far as I know, the total mass is still inferred to be less, but the error bar on that is fairly large. The work of Evans et al. Is, as far as I know, the most recent work on this. Now, most of what we are probing, say, with the giant southern stream or the orbit of 205, really probes the inner potential of Andromeda, because the constraints on the total mass really come from the outermost satellites. And as you know, there's been discovery of new satellites, and as we measure radial velocities for them, the number of traces will go up, and hopefully the error bars will go down.
Okay, another question is, I think it was James Bullock who was emphasizing yesterday, there ought to be a debris field around of stars, basically, in the halos of things, and it sort of looks like that's the case for M31, but does that really look like what he was talking about? And also, I don't know if you would comment on M33, which people have looked for these things and seen nothing, last I heard.
No, there are tentative detections of a stellar halo in Andromeda. I believe there's a paper by McConaughey et al. On the stellar... M33, sorry, yes.
Actually, just on M33, Annette Ferguson, who of course is part of McConaughey et al., they do see a halo in M33, but to be clear, they don't see any features like you're seeing in M31, which I think is what Stacey was asking about. The comment I had is that I really like this idea of being able to tie together several features due to one progenitor, because also in the Milky Way now, although we're finding more and more streams, we're realizing that more and more of the features are due to the Sagittarius dwarf.
Wrapping around many times.
Yes, yeah. Yes, and I think it's going to be really exciting to try to use the long-lived streams and the many wraps to really say more and more about the underlying potential of the
galaxy. Right, that's exactly right. I mean, if the moment something goes very close to the center and wraps around, to get the features exactly right, you have to get the potential right. The other thing, of course, is in the Andromeda stream, the stream looks asymmetric. It's sharp on one side and gradual on the other. And that's almost certainly because of some property of the satellite. It's probably a rotating satellite as opposed to the non-rotating hot satellites we've used here. So that's also an area of improvement that we're working on.
I was wondering whether you can constrain the velocity dispersion of this halo component you're seeing as far as 100 kiloparsecs away from the center of M31, and also whether you can detect deviations from this power law, fit. In other words, because what we expect, at least from the simulations, is that the halo will become steeper as you move further out, and also the velocity dispersion will become more radially dominant.
Will become more radially dominant, therefore the line of sight velocity dispersion should go down. There's indications of that in the data. We have, sorry? Not quite yet. We are, we've basically tripled our sample compared to that that star count map. The star count profile I showed you. So I think once we sift through all of the new data we've collected, especially by the end of this year, we should have numbers for both the fall off in velocity dispersion and more detailed information on both on the radial profile and on the azimuthal shape. That might be interesting as well.
Hi. Are you considering M32 also as a possible subject in this?
Not in the giant stream. Not in the giant stream, we think. It is... The giant stream comes into M31 from the south. M32 is also to the south, but it has an opposite radial velocity relative to the systemic velocity of M31. So M32 could be a culprit if it is already wrapped around M31. That is, it has to be separated from the giant stream by off the order of half an orbit. It couldn't be part of the same orbit.
And the obvious reason is, of course, that M32 is a bit weird.
That's right.
Compact
That's
object, right. So it's long to be thought to be a remnant of a bigger one.
If you believe this orbit that ties together the giant stream with the two shelves, M32 is not the progenitor. But I'm sorry. There are suggestions that there might be a largely disrupted core. The problem is it's probably against the dense face of M31, so it's not clear whether it'd be easily detectable. Nothing has been identified clearly so far.
One small additional. How does this compare with the rings found in the infrared, mid-infrared?
That's a very good question. The rings found in the infrared look very much like resonant rings in the disk of Andromeda. So far, our simulations have been using static potentials for representing Andromeda. I think it would be very interesting to ask the question of what is the effect of these encounters on M31's disk. And it wouldn't be out of the question for this encounter that produced the giant stream or the 205 encounter, which, by the way, seem to be two different encounters, to have excited this ring or to have excited a bar in the center of M31. There's now a very clear picture of the bar at the center of Andromeda. These things might all well be linked. It would be interesting, as Rosie says, if they were all tied together.
I was wondering why you don't see a tidal stream from M32.
We actually do. We actually do. This is the work of Phil Choi, and this goes back to the work of Kent and collaborators. You do see tidal extension. I wouldn't call it a stream, but you do see, in a couple of different ways, you see effects of tidal distortion in the outer parts of M32. If you look at the brightness profile, you see a clear, you see what looks like a divercular law, but then there's a cutaway and an excess beyond that. It's as though material has been removed from some radius and moved to a larger radius. You see that also in the elongation of the isophotes. We're trying to measure kinematics of stars in these regions of M32 to better constrain this. But we don't really see a long stream associated with M32, but there is evidence of tidal distortion.
Is that surprising that you don't see the tail?
It is superposed on a very dense part of the, on the Andromeda disk. And it really depends on how tightly bound, and it depends on M32's internal structure as well, as you know. So this might be saying something about how tightly bound M32 is, and how resistant it might be to tidal disruption. We see some evidence in the outer parts.
So one quick question before we
I'm not sure this answers your question, but let me try this. If you look at the numbers, look at the numbers over here. We're getting down to ridiculously low levels, 35th magnitude per square arc second. But that's because we're counting individual stars. And one can get even fainter than this if you count stars over a large area. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, let's say if you use that as a normalization of a normal IMF and you associate some dark matter with it, what kind of surface densities do you, kind of surface density fluctuations do you have, and how does it compare to the, let's say, total surface density along that line of sight?
I don't have the first number for you off the top, but the fluctuations are probably off the order of 100% in the outer halo. In other words, the RMS is off the order of mean probably in these outer halos, if you believe the simulations. We don't have enough data in enough fields to measure this, but this is obviously something we're interested in doing. How much fluctuation is there from field to field compared to the mean brightness?
Thank you. Okay, let's thank the speaker again. And I believe the festivities start at 2 p.m. Is that right?